This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, an effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. It's a safe, easy way to lower your blood pressure naturally, and it's so effective it works for 9 in 10 people. The Zona Plus is a high-tech smart device that guides you through a patented therapy that's personalized to your unique physiology. To find out more, go to tryzona.com or call toll-free 888-408-6141. As a listener to Intelligent Medicine, you can get $50 off and free shipping. Just use the coupon code Hoffman at checkout at tryzona.com. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. As a part of a series where we're discussing innovative cancer therapies, we talked about hyperbaric oxygen. We talked to Dr. Dominic D'Agostino about combining the ketogenic diet with hyperbaric oxygen therapy. Today, we're going to talk to one of the leading thinkers around these issues, Dr. Thomas Seyfried. He's written a book entitled Cancer as a Metabolic Disease, which has been very, very influential. He also was recently featured in the New York Times Magazine in an article entitled An Old Idea, Starve Cancer to Death. And while it's not quite as simple and straightforward as that, the basic idea is that cancer loves sugar, and a ketogenic diet, along with some other tweaks, can provide a less toxic alternative to our current cancer strategies. So in part one, Dr. Seyfried, you laid the groundwork for this concept, and then you talked about how you're refining your strategy to say, okay, the basic premise is, yes, a ketogenic diet, but then with certain add-ons. Can you describe what some of these add-ons might be?
Yes. Well, this is the idea. As I mentioned, the press-pulse concept. The press is the diet, and the pulse would be the add-ons. And add-ons can include other drugs used in concentrations that are not toxic but work synergistically to target further the availability of the two primary fermentable fuels that these tumor cells are using to divide and to survive and grow. And of course, that's glucose and glutamine. There have been a number of drugs, like, well, you even mentioned 2-fluorodeoxyglucose, 2-deoxyglucose. Mm-hmm. These are non-metabolizable analogs of glucose, and they can work synergistically. We published a paper showing that 2-DG and the ketogenic diet can be synergistic in shutting down the pathway needed for a lactic acid fermentation.
They sort of compete. They compete with glucose because they structurally are similar to glucose, and then they kind of
they have the very, very similar structure. They're taken up through the same transporter. They just can't be metabolized. They go to 2-deoxy-6-glucose-phosphate, which is then gums up the system.
That's so like putting a super glue in a lock or something to block it.
Yeah, it's just you can't. You know, it's like putting water in the gasoline. You know,
okay.
The engine just shuts down because you can't use the you can't use the fuel for it. Just gets stuck in the line. You know, it just doesn't. Mm-hmm. It starves. It shuts down two big pathways. One is the glycolytic pathway, and the other is the pentose phosphate pathway. The precursors of the pentose phosphate pathway build. That pathway builds the precursors needed for nucleotide DNA and RNA synthesis. So you're taking away the ability to put for the building blocks to make structure for the cell. The glutamine provides both energy, a source of energy, and also nitrogen, because you need the nucleic acids contain nitrogen. So you need those two fuels for all of the necessary lipids and proteins and nucleic acids. So people are very interested in targeting glutamine, and there's a number of reports, but a lot of these haven't worked. That's not to say they won't work in the future. Some are considered too toxic at this point. Others are considered ineffective. But there's been very little energy put into this area, very little attention. So it's not that we can't do it. We think we can. with just a little bit more tweaking of the system. And again, with glutamine, we have to be very careful because so many of the functions of our body, glutamine plays such an important role in that. So it has to be done very delicately and in the right strategy in order to deprive them of that fuel, while at the same time shutting down the glucose pathways. So it has to be done together with drugs and diet. And I think, in my view, I think this is going to be the solution to the problem.
So describe the ketogenic diet for those who are not acquainted with it. What does it consist of, and how do you practically implement such a restrictive program?
Well, you know, I got into this field a long time ago, and I've done a lot of work in the field of epilepsy, defining the mechanisms by which calorie restriction and ketogenic diets could block epileptic seizures. And the ketogenic diet is just a general term for a diet that has a large amount of fat, and it has very low carbohydrate with a moderate to low level of protein. It differs significantly from the Atkins diet in that it specifies what kind of fats should be there and has a much lower level of protein than does an Atkins diet. So an Atkins diet is not necessarily good for managing cancer because the protein levels are too high and a lot of the fats are inflammatory provocative. So, you know, people just can't go out and just say, well, I'm going to eat a lot of fat and it's going to get the... No.
You know, the ketogenic diet, order a bacon cheeseburger and throw away the bun. That's not the answer necessarily.
No, that's Atkins diet. But that's not going to stop your tumor because you still have too much energy generated from the protein that you're taking in. Mm-hmm. And you got to be very careful of the kinds of fats. You don't want these arachidonic acid, pro-inflammatory fatty acids in there. You want fats, short, medium chain fats that are going to generate a lot of ketones naturally from the liver. So you don't want other kinds of... And you also have to be careful about omega-3 fatty acids. They can be used, but the concentrations have to be very carefully monitored. Hmm. A ketogenic diet is an extremely sophisticated medical tool that must be wielded with respect. Otherwise, you could run into having a number of issues that could make it very difficult for the patient. So compliance now becomes a major issue. Having an appropriately formulated ketogenic diet that will bring glucose levels down into what we call therapeutic low ranges and ketone levels naturally produced in the body to therapeutically high levels while keeping the overall health and well-being of the patient on a high level. This is challenging. And people, physicians and nutritionists and dietitians need to know how to do this. And, you know, there's a ketone kitchen produced at CHOP and at UPenn. Christina Berkovic has trained many parents to use the correct ketogenic diets for managing epilepsy in their children. And I think the same kind of strategy will eventually be needed to help the oncology cancer patients use these diets in the correct way. So this is an emerging field that where a lot of skill and prior experience needs to be part of the problem, part of the solution. And physicians and nurses, they need to all know how to implement this and how to use it for each patient. So it's not as simple as people might think.
Yeah, it's not just cut the carbs and you'll be fine. Does the ketogenic diet, you know, because it's so restricted, does it make use of certain medical foods like medium chain triglycerides or coconut oil or things along those lines?
Yes, I mean they're all part of it. Coconut oil, and you also and the MCT oils. You can get those at Whole Foods, but to make a product, a food item that would be part of a menu, one has to use a variety of different foods that will always maintain the correct balance of fats, proteins, and carbohydrates, and allow that food to be utilized to produce ketones from our own body. And many cancer patients, I would say most, but many, can achieve, let's put it this way, they can achieve high enough ketosis, but not always low enough glucose. And this is a very interesting thing, different from the epilepsy population, the patients that have epilepsy. They seem to get into these metabolic zones easier than do the cancer patients. And we're not really sure about that, but we've noticed Stress management is an extremely important component.
Wow.
There's an anxiety that exists for many people with cancer that doesn't exist for people with epilepsy or some other kinds of conditions. And I think the knowledge of a person having a disease that could potentially be life-threatening creates anxiety. And that anxiety leads to elevated blood glucose levels, and it becomes a little bit more difficult to reduce the glucose levels. So we think a stress management component with an appropriately formulated ketogenic diet can be very effective in targeting the glucose, getting the patients into the correct metabolic zone, so that when we add the drugs that will work synergistically, these drugs will work much more effectively at much lower doses than would be needed if those drugs were tried by themselves without the diet. So the whole thing here is to get a really good therapeutic balance of the appropriate ratios of the different components of the ketogenic diet together with those drugs that work synergistically with this diet. And this may need to be tweaked up or down depending on the individual's own metabolism. So we need to know that. That's why one shoe does not fit all. This is really personalized medicine. This is the real statement of what personalized medicine is. In other words, you're going to design a therapy based on food and drug that's going to be suited for your individual metabolism, that's going to put you in these zones that we know can keep those tumor cells in check.
How do you monitor the efficacy of the ketogenic diet? How do you know that the person is achieving sufficient levels of ketone formation? In the Atkins Center, they just sent patients home with keto sticks. That's not very accurate. Now they have blood meters. Do you make use of those methods to see if people are really getting into the right metabolic zone?
Yes. So, this is a very important point. This is a very important question. And we developed we published a paper on the glucose ketone index calculator. We published this in Nutrition and Metabolism. And basically, we built this calculator because we realized how stressed out and how difficult it was for the patients to glean data from blood glucose ketone monitoring. They do that. We need the data from blood glucose ketone monitoring in a single meter. We were having patients record their daily blood glucose and daily ketones, blood ketones, not the urine sticks. You're absolutely right. They're not always indicative of the level of ketosis, which must be measured in the blood. But the patients were having a lot of trouble trying to convert milligrams per deciliter into millimolar and trying to do these calculations, and they were getting stressed out because sometimes their blood sugar was too high. And so we built, my students and I sat down and we figured this is what we're telling them in our original publications may be hard to do in practice. So we developed this calculator, and it works with a singular meter, like you said, a home testing kit. There's a meter. There's a couple of them. You know, we use the Abbott Laboratory Precision Extra, but there's others out there that we've tested. And you can take the sticks and you can measure the blood sugar as someone with diabetes might do on a daily basis. And then with the same drop of blood, you can put it on a ketone stick and measure the ketones. And then the calculator will you push the button, you add the information in, and you push the little we put the numbers into the, and you hit the button there, and it gives you a glucose ketone index ratio. And we have, based on meta-analysis, prior analysis, and our own ongoing experiments, we found that ratios of blood glucose to blood ketones in the order of 1.0 or below. And when you go below, that means there's basically more ketones circulating in your bloodstream than glucose on a millimolar level. This gives the patient a singular number. So they then are in charge of their own destiny with respect to this metabolic therapy. So they would record that on a daily basis, maybe once or twice a day, and then they would share this with their physician, either through the internet or by phone or however the communication system would be set up. And then they would know, and you could follow the daily shifts in blood glucose and ketones, and then you could follow. We followed some people for over 2 years on these systems, and you can see how long over this period are they in the so-called metabolic zone of 1.0 and below. And from our experience, the patients usually do better when they're in the, as long as they can stay in these zones. Now, this was with the diet alone, without much add-ons. So we're trying. So this gives the patient an opportunity to monitor for themselves, as it would a patient with diabetes, knowing whether they need insulin or whether they should have sugar or one of these things to balance their metabolism. So we can do a very similar strategy for the cancer patient, and this is the way we think we can help people know what they should eat, what they shouldn't eat, you know, because they ask us all the time, oh, can I eat this? Can I eat that? And I said, what does it do to your index? Mm-hmm. What does it do to your glucose ketone index? And then if it doesn't hurt it, then do that. If it does, then don't do that.
That's a fascinating vision for how cancer could ultimately become a disease that's managed very much in the way that diabetes is managed, with monitoring, with diet modification, certain medications, to keep you in the correct zone. Very interesting. Do cancer cells become resistant to this? Are there certain circumstances where, you know, cancer cells have evaded every known form of treatment to date, whether it's immunological treatments, whether it's chemotherapy, whether it's radiation? They seem to mutate in ways that enable them to survive the onslaught of most therapies. Is this something that you're seeing can emerge, or is it a universal property of cancer cells that they're at least somewhat responsive to this type of therapy?
Yeah, well, the issue of resistance. So, because, you know, people have gone on the ketogenic diet and they said, oh, my cancer returned. And did you target the glutamine? No. All right, so if you block that one source of energy to the cells, and you don't block the other source of energy, then it looks as though the cancer cells are resistant. As I said, it hasn't been effective so far that we have been able to, or has been used to show that if you block both glucose and glutamine, the cells can survive. So we have to say, okay, why do the cancer cells appear to be resistant to all of these different treatments? Mainly because the availability of the fuels that drive their fermentation have not been adequately restricted. So, as I said, so many of these therapies that have been used free up glucose and glutamine in the microenvironment, and then they say, "Oh, the cancer cells are so wily and tough and can maneuver out of all of these things and resistant." They're not resistant. You're giving them the fuels they need to grow. Mm-hmm. If they can't, how can they grow if the very metabolites needed for building the cell can't be synthesized? There's no way this can happen. So, I mean, what are they going to do? Okay, so you say, well, maybe they'll get acetate or aspartate or one of these other amino acids. And the answer is yes, the tumor cells can burn those and use them for energy, use these fermentation pathways. The problem is those fuels are in such low levels in the mm-hmm. microenvironment, they're not likely to be sufficient to keep that group of cells alive for very long. You'll use it up. It's like a limited resource. Mm-hmm. You just don't have a lot of it. What you have a lot of is glucose and glutamine, and none of the therapies that are being used today are sufficiently targeting those available fuels, making it appear that these tumor cells are resistant. You never targeted what they're really using to stay alive.
Indeed.
It's not that complicated.
What's the additive effect of hyperbaric oxygen? How does that become an adjunctive therapy?
Okay, well, we thought this way. If you treat patients with radiation, the tumor, the radiation generates reactive oxygen species that basically, you know, destroys the membranes and destroys the tumor cells. So hyperbaric oxygen will also generate reactive oxygen species in cells that produce more reactive oxygen species. It will produce, like in cancer cells that have inefficient respiration, reactive oxygen species. These cells already produce a lot of reactive oxygen species, but they're not, they don't die because they use so much glucose and glutamine. The glucose and glutamine support the antioxidant capacity of the cells, right? So the glucose and glutamine are making the tumor cells resistant to reactive oxygen species. So the question is if you lower the availability of glucose and glutamine and now put them in an environment where we're elevating oxygen,
it's more stress. It just stresses the cancer cells more.
You're going to kill those tumor cells by the same mechanism that radiation kills them, but in a totally non-toxic way. So you won't be damaging collateral damage to normal cells, and you'll be targeting specifically the tumor cells. And the normal cells don't experience this because they burn ketones. And the beta-hydroxybutyrate leads to an increase in the redox span of the CoQ couple, which produces fewer oxygen species in the mitochondria of the normal cells. So this is a really elegant way to select the tumor cells for ROS destruction while protecting the normal cells. This is very elegant. This is a very, it's just that nobody knows about it. Nobody's doing it. It's just one of those things.
So what are the obstacles to acceptance of this paradigm? Because it seems that all the efforts of cancer researchers, billions and billions, perhaps trillions of dollars, are being consecrated to looking at other avenues of cure. I was watching something on 60 Minutes the other night about injecting polio vaccine into the brains of patients with glioblastoma. It's a very risky proposition, very high tech, very expensive, but it's beginning to show some promise. No mention of diet, no mention of hyperbaric oxygen. You know, a conspiracy theorist might suggest that perhaps some of these therapies might be less lucrative for pharmaceutical companies because we're talking about old drugs and a diet therapy that people can't, frankly, patent or make that much money off of.
Well, you know, this is a point that needs to be, everybody, it's not everybody, I think so many people say this. And my view is, why should the pharmaceutical industry, with a very poor track record, be the deciders about what people should use to treat their cancer? You know, one has to question an institution that has perpetuated an approach that has been less than successful. Now, they can argue, and there is legitimate, well, we've saved so many thousands and thousands of patients using these toxic therapies. And that's true. I'm not saying that none of this works. The question is, it puts these people now at a risk for all kinds of other health maladies that they never had. Depression is very significantly elevated. Gastrointestinal problems, cardiovascular problems are now recognized at a much higher degree in the so-called survivors of cancer who have taken these other therapies. Yes, so are we to select only therapies that are financially lucrative to an industry with a poor track record or to hospitals that generate tremendous revenue from very therapies that we're speaking about? So this is an issue, a very important issue that has to be dealt with. Is the goal to provide sufficient revenue for the medical industry, or is the goal to effectively manage the disease without toxicity? And the other thing that stands in the way is if cancer is a genetic disease, then the kinds of therapies that are being used today to treat patients is in line with that concept. Now, if cancer is not a genetic disease and it's a mitochondrial metabolic disease, then it becomes clear why we have we've had such a poor track record in trying to manage the disease. The very underpinnings, the very concept of what the disease is, it has been misinterpreted. Okay, so we have a lot of major issues that have to be evaluated. Now, one of the strategies that I think could have potential is the global financing, the approach of global financing as an alternative to fee-for-service. And this sprang out of the Obamacare initiatives. And this is where hospitals are given a certain amount of money to manage the patients in their practices. And if the patients can remain out of the hospital and in a healthy state, the hospital will share in the revenue, as opposed to fee-for-service, where the patients are coming in and each test is added onto the bill. So the
right,
issue
right
then
now
is
we have perverse incentives. We have incentives that generate revenues, and you know, in spite of efforts to reform our healthcare system, it's still basically revenue centered.
Right. Right. So if global financing, and NPR did a very nice study about the differences between global financing and fee for service, and global financing could significantly reduce the costs associated with some of these treatments, and could potentially provide patients with a much higher quality of life and extended survival. Now, the issue, of course, is that people will, and often I hear, if this is so great and wonderful, this metabolic approach to cancer management, why are there no clinical trials? Where is the evidence? Where is this? Where is that? And the answer is, well, who usually funds these clinical trials? The pharmaceutical companies. They're the ones that have the big bucks that can afford to do all that. So we have that issue. We have several issues. It's not just the one issue. Okay, the other issue is that a lot of these trials are based on double-blind crossover. And this is a little bit more challenging when you're putting in diet therapies where people know what they're actually getting.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's hard to disguise this diet with a placebo diet.
Yeah, well, we did it for my colleagues in the epilepsy field, did it for epilepsy. Mm-hmm. They would not believe that the ketogenic diet could be as good or better than the best pharmacy for managing epileptic seizures. And Freeman and Helen Cross from the UK, John Freeman from Johns Hopkins, and Eric Kossoff and Adam Hartman and a variety of others, Beth Zupek Kenya, they all put together a double-blind crossover for children with epilepsy and proved that the ketogenic diet is superior to drugs. But they still don't want to use it. It's just not revenue generating, despite the fact that you can show in a double-blind crossover that it doesn't have the therapeutic benefit that was touted. Now, of course, we're going to see the same thing in the cancer field. Even if this works and is shown in trials that it can be powerful, effective, there's going to be tremendous resistance to using this. So where will the break point come? And in my mind, it's going to come from the patients themselves. It's not going to come from the pharmaceutical industry, and it's not going to come from the top medical schools, which are vested in the gene theory of cancer. So it's going to come from the patients. It's going to come from the grassroots. It might take time. I don't know how long it's going to take, but it's going to happen, because what we can't do is continue to do what we've been doing. It doesn't work.
And apropos of that, what is the Charlie Foundation, a foundation that you have some involvement with?
Yeah, the Charlie Foundation was set up by Jim Abrams and his family to help his son Charlie use the ketogenic diet. He was very impressed. His son almost died from the standards of care that were used at that time. And then he became so upset, and he brought his son to Johns Hopkins. My former colleague passed away, John Freeman, and the group at Johns Hopkins saved Charlie's life, and he became very resistant to seizures. He's a mature young man. He's going on with his life. And Jim became so angry about no one knowing about this ketogenic diet therapy, he set up his own foundation called the Charlie Foundation in honor of his son Charlie. And his goal was to bring awareness in the medical community to how these ketogenic diets have powerful medicinal effects and can be used as an alternative to toxic pharmacy for managing epilepsy. And I think that was the spark that generated tremendous interest. And, you know, I worked in the early part of that whole initiative with that, but I was also working on cancer. And then we just simply transitioned this whole thing over to the cancer field. In fact, we can explain better how ketogenic diets can manage cancer than we can explain or understand how ketogenic diets manage epileptic seizures. That's a field that's going to continue an attempt to understand that for decades. But the fact is that it works. It works really well if it's done well, and these children can do get back with their schoolwork and become a part of the society and the family again. So they're not all zoned out by the heavy drug use. And I think we can do the same thing in the cancer field. It's just that the institutional systems that surround the cancer industry is so much more entrenched than they were around the epilepsy field.
Right. And so the Charlie Foundation, the website is charliefoundation.org. CHARLIE foundation.org. And so what's today's Intelligent Medicine call to action? First, I'll call our audience's attention to the fact that you can see Dr. Seyfried. He will be speaking at a complimentary event upcoming on June 2nd. That's a Thursday from 7 to 10 p.m. On Long Island in Nassau County at Hyperbaric Medical Solutions. That's 80 Crossways Park Drive in Woodbury, New York. And you can get information about that from a gentleman named Ramon Garcia at 516-584-9010. That's 516-584-9010. And they will be serving ketogenic snacks. Hopefully they will pass muster with you, Dr. Seyfried. Have you already inspected the menu? Does it meet your standards?
No, I haven't.
Okay. Hopefully it'll conform to what you believe to be a true ketogenic diet. And so from your standpoint, what are some of the resources that you can point patients to in addition to your speaking engagement, which you hope some of our listeners and perhaps some of our medical colleagues will attend?
Travis Christofferson put out a nice book called Tripping Over the Truth, The Metabolic Theory of Cancer. I think that book is much less expensive than my book, and it kind of covers the historical emergence of this concept over the years. I know that Ellen Davis has put out a book on ketogenic diets to help cancer patients. So is Patricia Daly in Ireland. I think, and there's also Matthew's Friends, which is kind of the parallel of Charlie Foundation in the UK. More and more information is coming out, and more people are becoming interested in this and discussing it with their physicians and caregivers. So I think it's an emerging field. We hope that it can move faster. I think you'll see more and more YouTube videos on the web talking about ketogenic diets. There's a huge area of ketogenic diet for weight loss, and that's another another area that people are interested in the weight management field. In the type 2 diabetes field, it's moving into the Alzheimer's disease field. And the Charlie Foundation also has now opened up ketogenic diets for all kind of other diseases, in addition to epilepsy, where they originally started, but they're into the cancer and the Alzheimer's and this kind of thing. So people can get an idea more about how these medical diet therapies, used as food as medicine, this kind of an approach. And I think this is going to be a very interesting development as more and more evidence comes in supporting the concept.
Well, I want to thank you very much for your generous contribution of time and for your wonderful work. And you are certainly a bold and courageous and ingenious pioneer. And hopefully, and already, you're certainly creating waves in the cancer paradigm. And hopefully these ideas will prevail and help us move closer towards less toxic ways of dealing with cancer. So thank you so much, Dr. Thomas Seyfried, for joining us.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.